What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. Glad to have you with us on this Wednesday afternoon. This program is for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, not quite sure where to get the answer for that, what the Catholic Church actually teaches, well, we are here for you. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. When you do that, you're going to get a quick robo response. When you get that, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also send us an email whenever you wish. ctc@ewtn.com is the address for that. ctc@ewtn.com. All right, who have we got here? Matt Kabinski handling the phones, and Pedro Quiles, our producer, Rich Jesse on social media. If you are watching us perhaps today on YouTube or Facebook, we are streaming right now. Just put your question in the chat screen, if you would, please. Rich will then see that. He'll send it to us here in the studio. Again, the phone number, 833-288-EWTN. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am well. How are you?
You know, I'm doing decent. Thank you.
Hanging in there with the sweltering summer that we're having.
Welcome to Alabama.
It's daunting. Another week, they say another week, and we'll be in the clear.
Great.
Looking forward to that. Looking forward to the end of allergy weather, which is kind of rough right now. So we're going to lead off today with a question from Nicole in Virginia. Dear Dr. Anders, I was recently speaking with a Protestant friend who is seriously considering entering the Catholic Church. One of her biggest difficulties is understanding the Catholic teaching on the Blessed Virgin Mary, especially the belief in her sinlessness throughout her early life. She shared that this teaching makes it hard for her to relate to Mary, as she sometimes imagines Mary's sinlessness to mean that she was emotionally distant, lacking struggle, robotic, or somehow less human. Could you help explain what Mary's sinlessness might have looked like in her daily life? Thanks, Nicole in Virginia.
Oh, I love this question. This is a fantastic question. So here's, if I had your friend at the table with me, we were talking, I would ask this question. I would say, okay, so do you want to be sinless in your own life? I mean, are you striving? Would you aspire to not sin? Well, yeah, of course. I don't want to sin.
Sure.
So are you striving to be emotionally distant and robotic? Because you just said that if Mary's sinless, then that she seems to you emotionally distant and robotic. Are you striving to be emotionally distant and robotic? Because, see, in my experience, I mean, I've known people that were pretty seriously evil folks. Seriously evil folks. And what does serious evil have in common? Seriously evil people put themselves at the center of the world. And they just don't give a you-know-what if who they run over and crush to get what they want. You know, it's like the fellow I know of this guy. Someone that ran in circles that were in circles that were near my circles. And his wife found out he was committing adultery. She called him on it. He said, well, I'll try and cut back.
Ooh, not a good answer.
No, not a good answer, right? And the point was, like, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, woman, because I'm all about me, right? That's the picture of sin, right? When you think about the worst, most the most evil people you can conceive of, sex traffickers, child traffickers, genocidal maniacs, you name it. What do they all have in common? Well, they treat human beings as objects, right? As means to the ends of their own personal gratification.
Yeah.
What do good people have in common? Well, they treat people as ends and not means. They're not all about themselves. And they make themselves available to others because they actually feel empathy. I mean, psychopaths feel no empathy. They don't suffer when others suffer. Good people suffer when others suffer. That's the definition of good. The better you are, the more morally perfect you are, the more emotionally available you are. And you know this from your own experience. You know this, right? And you have to have a fairly, I think, distorted view of what virtue is, of what goodness is, to think that growth in virtue and holiness and love means becoming less and less human. On the contrary, I mean, the Catholic tradition has always taught, but not just the Catholic tradition, I think human wisdom teaches, that the more depraved you are, the less human you are.
Hmm.
And so, precisely because of her holiness, Mary would have been the most emotionally available person ever to live.
Yeah, so to describe her average day would be like to describe the average day of pretty much anybody.
Well, it would
not
have been,
to be distant.
In that, I mean, there's someone in your life that you admire, some woman you have known who is just an exemplary person, who makes sure that everybody has what they need, who's always running around caring for other people, who makes herself available, you know, who sees a need and fulfills it, right? Imagine that character that you want to be like. I mean, we all want to be that person. We want our kids to look back on us when we are on our deathbeds and think, gosh, my mom and dad was a good person. You know, we want that identity. Well, Mary was that, only more so.
Only more so. Fantastic. And Nicole in Virginia, thank you for the most excellent question. In a moment, we're going to get to the phones. But before we do that, I want to give an invitation to you. If you would like to send us an email for a future show, here's the address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. You know, there's multiple ways of reaching us, obviously on the phones, obviously email, but also the other platforms, YouTube, Facebook, texting, however you can get to us, that's how we want to hear from you. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Kurt in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Normally, we have like a 30-day policy on phone calls. However, at the end of the show yesterday, David made the invitation, please call us back. Kurt took us up on that, so every now and then there are exceptions to that rule. So we'll get to Kurt in just a moment. We'll also talk with Greg in Minnesota. And several lines are open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. It's called Communion on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. Do stay with us. Glad you're with us for a call to communion on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. We have two lines open, 833-288-3986. Wonderful new book available for you from EWTN Publishing. It is called Faith and the Emotions, How to Open Your Heart to God's Transforming Grace, Peace and Happiness by Father Wojciech Giertych. He is the theologian to the papal household, and in this book he equips you to develop a healthy functioning of your emotions through a deeper encounter with God. Through the advice of St. Thomas Aquinas and other great spiritual masters, Father Giertych names and explains the reality of emotions to help form young adults to grow in virtue, develop mature identities, and be freed from painful anxieties and emotional entanglements. Again, here it is, Faith and the Emotions, How to Open Your Heart to God's Transforming Grace, Peace, and Happiness by Father Wojciech Giertych. It's available now at EWTNRC.com. Buy Catholic, shop Catholic, EWTNRC.com. All right, let's get to the phones here if you're ready at 833-288-EWTN. We're going to begin with our repeat offender here, Kurt, in the Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on the great Holy Family Radio. Hey, Kurt, thanks for calling us back. Please recap your question for us.
Right. Yeah. So thanks for taking the call. Yesterday I wanted to get Dr. Anders' most important similarity and also the most important difference between Catholicism, and I said Calvinism yesterday, but I really want to make it Dr. Andrews' choice whether you go for Calvinism or just lump all Protestantism into the other side of the Venn diagram. I kind of want to tease out of a Venn diagram of similarities and differences the most important difference and the most important similarity.
Oh, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So it's definitely more fun for me to answer the Calvinism question because it's the area that I feel most confident about and I've spent the most time studying. But I can and Protestantism is a broad umbrella, right? So let me zero in on Calvinism, and we can talk about differences from other Protestant traditions in the in context. So one thing to keep in mind about Calvinism is that Calvin, like all the other reformers, but to a unique extent, really did not intend to establish some new religious movement. That in his own mind, his ideology was not about breaking away from the Catholic Church and starting something new. In fact, integral to the Reformation propaganda was the idea that they were refurbishing, if you will, they were cleaning up the one continuous Holy Catholic Church down through the centuries. And they saw themselves very much in continuity with the Church of Antiquity, with the Church of Augustine, certainly with the Church of the New Testament, but even the Church of the Early Middle Ages. And the metaphor that Calvin used himself to describe his relationship to historic Christianity was that the one Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church had never gone away, but it had gotten, you know, its face had gotten sullied. It had been sort of buried under smoke that was the smoke of papal superstition. And his job was simply to blow the smoke away and let the burning embers that had never gone out come to life again. And that's how he saw himself. And so there are a lot of things about Calvin's Reformation that were very self-consciously Catholic. Work on Calvin's Liturgy of Geneva show its direct dependence and roots in the Roman Rite of the Mass, for example. Calvin's theology of the Church, I mean, when you break open the Institutes of the Christian Religion into Book 4, the section on the Church, he begins with a panegyric to the Church that any Catholic theologian would get misty over about the Church being our mother and absolutely essential for our salvation, and then you can't be joined to Christ if you can't have God as his father if he doesn't have the Church as his mother. That kind of language is all through Calvin. He had a robust doctrine of ordination and of the authority of the Reformed ministry. In my own doctoral dissertation, I have a chapter in my dissertation on Calvin on the Reformed Magisterium, because he definitely has a doctrine of the Church's magisterium as a teaching authority that is distinct, clearly very distinct from the role of the lay people. And in fact, when you trace this through Calvin's controversies, it's very interesting because there were people in Calvin's own church in Geneva who would have pled a very sort of fundamentalist, evangelical-sounding polemic against Calvin. They would say things like, well, hey, I have the Holy Spirit same as you, and the Bible is my authority, not you, not sacred tradition. And so if I read the Bible and I come to a different interpretation than you, John Calvin, then I have to follow my conscience. My conscience is held captive to the Word of God, yada, yada, yada. I don't submit to the authority of men, so on and so forth. And I mean, that's like good-sounding Protestant verbiage. And Calvin's response was essentially, you have no jurisdiction, you have no mission, you have no authority in the church to interpret the scriptures. That's the role of the properly ordained ministry, you know, a pox on your house and let's burn you at the stake. And I'm not being metaphorical or exaggerating. He literally wanted that for, say, Jerome Bolslik, okay? So he clearly saw himself as an apostolic authority on the order of, say, the Catholic Episcopacy or the Papacy. In fact, Max Ingemar wrote a great article for the journal Church History, some 25 years ago now probably, called Calvin, Prophet Without a Prophecy, about Calvin's self-understanding as someone who occupied a prophetic role with all the sort of supernatural endowment of authority that would be implicated in that identity role. And he was clearly seen that way by many of his contemporaries. Alexandre Ganoche wrote a wonderful book called Calvin, Theologian of the Church and of the Ministry, which really stresses these continuities with Catholicism. Calvin's sacramentalism also clearly has roots in Roman Rite Catholic practice. Catholic had a doctrine of the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. He didn't believe in transubstantiation, but he did believe in a substantial partaking in the body and blood of the Lord. That's the language that he uses in the Institutes. He considered the doctrine of Christ's presence in the Eucharist to be essential for salvation, so necessary for salvation. He says that in his little treatise on the Lord's Supper. And so you read all this stuff and you're like, this this does not sound like the Presbyterian down the street. No, it does not. No, it does not. In fact, when I was studying Calvin, I began to have the realization, my gosh, they wouldn't let this person teach Sunday school in my Presbyterian church because he sounds way too Catholic, right? The big point of difference, however, is that even though he did believe in a kind of apostolic succession, if you trace the line of apostolic succession in Calvin's theology, it doesn't go from St. Peter to the reigning pontiff of his own day, right? It goes from the College of the Apostles to, wait for it, John Calvin.
Shocking.
All right. And the process of transmission is a little bit different, right? In that, you know, he basically thought that you couldn't have the transmission of the office without the doctrine. And of course, he gets to define the content of the doctrine that qualifies you as a legitimately authorized Reformed minister.
Yeah.
But to show how serious they were about this idea of succession, you look in early 18th century French Reformed Church. There was a period where the French Reformed Church sort of fell into disarray, and there was a reformer named Antoine Court who wanted to reestablish ecclesiastical consistorial discipline after the Genevan model. Interestingly, he traveled to Geneva to receive ordination before he would go back to France and reestablish the Reformed Church. I mean, the symbolic significance of that gesture, I think, couldn't possibly be lost on you. He had to get the laying on of hands from those reputed to be pillars, right? You know, and to use biblical language.
Sure.
So all these things are very deeply Catholic in their sort of disposition. Here, to my way of looking at it, is the biggest difference. And we can talk about sola scriptura and sola fide and these kinds of things, but dispositionally, right, if you live the inside of the thing, what is the biggest difference between being a Calvinist and being a Catholic? It's something that John Henry Newman put his finger on in the Apologia Pro Vita Sua, his autobiography. And I think Newman was right, that when you are a Calvinist, you hold as a dogma the possibility of having an infallible knowledge of your own salvation, an infallible knowledge of your own election. And the world is divided between those that are elect and saved and can be identified as elect and saved and everybody else. And so your stance vis-a-vis the rest of the world is that of the self-confidently saved over against those that about whom you have grave doubts about their salvation, but you don't have grave doubts about yours, right? And the disposition of a Catholic in the world is to say, look, I have certainty about where grace is found. I know where the means of grace are. I know what I need to do to be saved. But like when her ecclesiastical interrogators asked Joan of Arc, are you in the grace of God? She gave a brilliant and Catholic answer. She said, if I'm not, may God put me there. If I am, may God keep me there.
Wow.
That's not a Calvinist answer.
No.
But that's a Catholic answer.
Yeah.
And of course, it flows from all those other differences about the basis of authority and the nature of grace and salvation. But when I went personally from being a Calvinist to being a Catholic, that was a sea change in my orientation to the world. And I found it profoundly liberating. You know, the Protestant characterizes the Catholic, satirizes, caricatures the Catholic as being a kind of neurotic nut job who's constantly chewing on his own fingernails, worrying about the state of his soul, right? I didn't find that as a Catholic at all. What I found was tremendously unburdened with the obligation to judge my neighbor, right? As a Calvinist, I had to know for sure I was going to heaven, and I had to presume my neighbor was going to hell. And I had this obligation to try to manufacture a change of his mind so that he would come to think and see the world the way I did.
Mm.
And it was a profoundly dehumanizing way to relate to people. It was like I was the spiritual Amway salesman and I could never turn it off. And then when I became Catholic, I thought, oh, you know, Jesus said, take the log out of my own eye rather than the splinter out of my neighbor's. And it opened the world to me in a way that Calvinism had profoundly closed off.
How freeing.
It was freeing.
Wow.
I'll tell you a great book on Calvinism by Philip Benedict. He's not a Calvinist, he's a Jew, but he's a wonderful historian. It's called A Social History of Calvinism by Philip Benedict. It's a great book.
There you go. Kurt, thanks so much for your call. Thanks for calling us back today. And that opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN, 833 888-398-3986. It's called A Communion in Progress here with Dr. David Anders on EWTN. Let's go now to Greg in Minnesota, listening online, EWTN.com. Hey, Greg, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hi. Well, thanks for taking my call, and it's always a great program.
Thank you.
You know, one thing I've always been unclear on is, you know, well, we talk about accompaniment, you know, and the people in our lives that are marginalized or confused. And, you know, there are times where it seems like a good thing to accompany folks, but then our Lord has these things that he says. And I'm wondering just basically how far to stick my neck out. You know, our Lord says, for example, you know, in addition to the things that give example for accompaniment, like the parable of the, you know, Good Samaritan and so forth, I accept that. But then our Lord says things that seem contrary, like don't throw your pearls to the pigs. And I just am wondering, it's like I have people in my life that lead really, really disordered and, complicated, even a bit wild and crazy lives. And it almost seems like in the Lord's Prayer, Lord, lead us not into temptation. I mean, you know, like our Lord goes himself to a brothel. I mean, am I supposed to go to a brothel? I don't think that would be a good idea for me. You know, and there are other
situations. I agree, by the way.
I agree about going
to the brothel. Don't do that, but carry on.
I can accompany somebody there. I think I'm being led into temptation. And I encounter all these people in my life that want me to abandon my Catholic faith, and I'm a racist and a homophobe if I don't. I mean, how far do I stick my neck out with this accompaniment deal?
Sure.
Got
so
it.
Let me tell you a story, if I might, that... well, first of all, on the last point you made, St. Paul says the same thing in Galatians chapter 6, verse 1. He says, brothers and sisters, if someone is caught in a sin, you who live by the Spirit should restore that person gently, but watch yourself or you may also be tempted. So the apostle anticipated the problem that you raise. And the question is, if there's an occasion of sin that I'm placing myself in order to quote unquote accompany someone,
yeah,
then that's foolishness. That's not wisdom, and I don't go there. And I say, you know, we don't have to be. Paul was all things to all people. I can't be all things to all people, right? I can't. I mean, me as the chaplain to an NBA basketball team, it ain't gonna happen, right? It's just I'm not even tall enough for one thing. You know, I mean, it's just not even gonna happen. I'm not gonna be everything to everyone.
Sure.
I have to find the place in the vocation of my life where I can be of service. But let's talk about this concept of marginalization. And does it have to mean someone who is lost in some sort of wayward life, right? I don't think so. I met a woman one time who told me, I hate the Eucharist. And I hate hearing about the Eucharist. Because when I hear of the Eucharist, I can only think about how much God must hate me. And her reasoning went like this. That I go to Catholic churches and I see people who seem visibly to be caught up in a kind of rapture and glory in their reception of the Eucharist because they are so certain of God's love, but I have never been more certain in my life that they don't care a fig about whether I live or die.
Hmm.
And so if they're communing deeply and lovingly with the Lord and they're not giving me the time of day, if they're correct in their estimation of their own holiness, then it must mean God loves them and hates me. And so the Eucharist is not a sign of God's love for me. It's a sign of God's hatred of me. That was this person's disposition. Now, let me bring that around on the other side of the break to what accompaniment would mean in that person's case.
Greg, sit tight with us. We'll continue in a moment. We'll also talk with George in New Jersey, Timothy in Los Angeles, and hopefully you as well at 833-288-EWTN here on Call to Communion. Called Communion in Progress here on EWTN. Not too late for you to call 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Before the break, we were talking with Greg in Minnesota, talking about the trials that one might accompany, that one might go through when accompanying the marginalized.
Right. And so Greg's dilemma was that, you know, there are people whose lives are really disordered.
Yeah.
And for me to go out and accompany them puts me in the path of temptation.
Yeah.
My first comment was the apostle acknowledges that there are situations. You know, Jesus was not going to fall into temptation by going and ministering to prostitutes.
Right.
Some other guy might fall into temptation, so maybe that's not the best ministry for him.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's not the best ministry for him. And I told a story about another kind of marginalization, someone who might be sitting in the pew next to you every week at Mass, whose life does not seem particularly disordered. But what you don't know is that person is racked with a kind of pain and loneliness that has profoundly alienated them from the people of God and from the church and even from the Eucharist. And you wouldn't know because you've never given that person the time of day. Or maybe that person, you have given that person the time of day, but when they come to you with their problems and objections about the Catholic faith, you give them all the reasons that they're wrong, right? And you argue with them about why their feelings are not valid and how they really should have this wonderful experience of Catholicism, and if only they could see things like you do. And then what you've done is you've just reinforced the problem,
yeah.
Right? And, you know, I've told the story many times on the air about a period in my life that was extremely difficult when a Catholic priest came to our home and had absolutely nothing to say, but just came and sat with us. And he didn't have an agenda, you know. He wasn't trying to change us. He wasn't trying to convince us of something. He wasn't trying to tell us why our problems were not the way they seemed or that they would get better or anything of the sort. He just was there.
For, I believe, 2 hours, wasn't it?
Several, more like four. Right?
Really?
Yeah, just there. Just
wow.
Just present. Just
wow.
Just bringing the gift of himself, right?
Mm.
And the older I get in life and in Catholic experience, you know, the more I think that it's just showing up for another human being is the key thing. I mean, it is the root and foundation of every other form of love. If you don't show up, you can't really be there for another human being in any capacity at all. And there's so much pain and there's so much hurt and there's so much suffering in this world that, I mean, St. Therese taught us, you don't have to go climb Mount Everest in the spiritual life to do something great for God. All you have to do is open your eyes to the person right next door to you, maybe in your own home, that's hurting and suffering in ways that you've never bothered to consider, and you can be present to them. So Mother Teresa, that was her concept. I mean, she did amazing things for God, right, and drew worldwide attention, but she didn't tell people to come join the Missionary of Charities.
No.
The Missionaries of Charity. She said, start with the people in your house. Accompany them.
Yeah.
Accompany them. You know, many times on the show, I've praised my dad, who was just a tremendous guy, and I miss him every day that he was gone, and he was a great attorney and a businessman, had a wonderful career, and had a lot of accomplishments in life. But what I know about him was that all those things were all interesting, but it was that he was there for me, right? He was there for me. And I remember one time I was in high school, and I was a weepy, moany, self-pitying, narcissistic, you know, selfish kid who'd got dumped by his girlfriend and thought that the world had come to a halt and everybody else's world had to come to a halt in consequence. And my dad was on his way to the airport to go get on a plane to go seal some deal for a client. And we didn't have cell phones in that day, but I managed to get him right before he left the office. And I'd never asked him to do this before, but I got him on the phone and I said, Dad, and he said, yeah. I said, what are you doing? He says, I'm getting ready to get on a plane. And I said, could you not? He said, I'm coming home.
Wow.
To this day, I don't know what that cost him, you know, but I know whatever he gave up was like a big deal for me, and I just needed him. I just needed my dad, and he was like, he didn't ask questions. He was, I'm on my way.
All right.
And he just came home, you know.
Wow.
That's accompaniment.
Yes.
And it can be your child. It can be your spouse. It can be your best friend. It can be your neighbor. Start small, you know. I mean, seriously, you know, just get in the mindset of I'm going to be there for somebody. And I guarantee you, once you open yourself up to that possibility, God will give you the people to accompany, because there's plenty of them out there. You don't have to go looking. Now, you know, every once in a while, you get the crusader who has a mission to save the world, and they actually have some talent that they can put to work in some cause, you know. I listened to a lecture once by Temple Grandin, the famous animal science professor from Colorado State University, and she talked about all these kids that come to college and they have this agenda that they're going to become activists and go out and protest and, you know, front of the halls of Congress to change the world. She said, you know what I did? I became an expert in a field where I could materially benefit, you know, a slice of reality. And she did. She like made major accomplishments in the field of cattle handling that made a huge difference in the lives of animals and their owners, right? Because she had the technical expertise to do it in that field. And she says, that's the way to change the world. You know, you find your lane where you can be effective. Could be something great, might be something small, but there's plenty of people to accompany.
Absolutely. Greg, we hope that's helpful for you. Thanks so much for your great call there. It is called Communion here on EWTN. Timothy is very patient. He's living in Los Angeles, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Timothy, what's on your mind today?
I think it's all probably in the same topic. I just wanted to get a clear understanding on the Catholic position, the Christian position. But, you know, like you're reading the old Bible on Samuel 15, 2-3. I don't know if Dr. Andis could look at it and kind of explain that between that and the juxtaposition that to Christ movement. God is in the Old Testament. God has been revealed in the New Testament. But it's kind of a little bit more genocidal in terms of, you know, go after me.
I have a lot to say about that. The first thing I'd like to say is that the Catholic tradition has always recognized that the Old Testament is a difficult book. One of the great Catholic theologians of all time, St. Augustine of Hippo, as a young man, he was raised in a Catholic family. At least he had a Catholic mother.
Mm-hmm.
She brought him up in the Catholic Church, but he didn't have a great experience. And then he was a pretty smart guy, pretty academic, and he liked to read classical literature. I guess then it was contemporary literature, but classical from our point of view. The greats. He liked to read the greats.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the myths and, you know, Homer and the Odyssey and so forth. And anyway, so he picks up the Old Testament. He reads the Old Testament. He says, this is a terrible book. I'm not going to believe this. So he leaves the Catholic faith. It was just as clear as he read the Bible. He says, this is awful. I'm not going to be Catholic. He left the Catholic Church because of the Bible. It was a terrible book. He didn't want it, any part of it. And there are lots of Catholics have realized, like, this is a difficult book. It has some passages in there that are quite tricky, all right? Augustine's path back into Catholicism was initially through philosophy, but he had to get around the problem of the Old Testament.
Mm.
And he started sitting in on lectures given by Ambrose, the bishop of Milan. And Ambrose explained to him that the Catholic way of reading the Old Testament. And the New Testament does this, so the Catholics aren't making it up. We learned it from Christ and St. Paul. But he says, look, we read the Old Testament allegorically. And we also read it developmentally, right? That the Old Testament represents a stage in the spiritual development of the people of God on their way towards the Messiah. And taken, you know, prima facie, it does not represent the perfection of God's will for humanity. Christ himself says this in Matthew chapter 19 when he's confronted with the Pharisees about a different matter in the book of Deuteronomy. And let me tell you something. You want to curl your toes or your hair, go read all the legislation in Deuteronomy. There's some really good legislation in Deuteronomy. There's some stuff in there that makes you really want to cringe.
Okay? Yeah, yeah.
And Christ knows this, and so he says about this legislation, he says, not like that from the beginning, not God's will, right? That this was a concession to human weakness given the times. Now, modern critical historical study of the Old Testament has added another wrinkle to this that's actually quite helpful. And that is that a lot of the events of the exile are told retrospectively from the point of view of people who live... A lot of the events of the Exodus and the early monarchy are told by narrators that are writing from the point of view of post-exilic Judea. And so some of the dramatic action is actually projected backwards and reflects the experience of post-exilic, say, you know, 5th, 4th, 3rd century Judea rather than 12th century Israel. And so some of the impetus towards, like, let's kill all the Canaanites may reflect what you see in some of the Psalms, where post-exilic peoples in Israel have seen their children bashed against rocks.
Oof.
They've seen their wives ravished. They've seen their young men put to the sword. They've been disinherited, right? They've had their lands taken from them. They've been carried into exile. And it's an understandable, if not entirely forgivable, response on the part of a human being to say, God, pay back to the people who did this to me what I had coming to me, right? Let me break the teeth of the wicked, O God. They broke my teeth, you break theirs. And thus we read in the imprecatory Psalms, break the teeth of the wicked, O God, bash their little ones' heads against rocks. It's in there. Go read it. I mean, it's not frequent, but you find that language, right? And my point is, does the evidence show, historical evidence, the archaeological evidence, that Israel in fact committed genocide? No, it doesn't show that. That's actually not what the archaeological record shows, that's not how it happened. It may be some imaginative reconstruction on the part of post-exilic peoples, a narrative, a lament written in the form of a narrative, right?
Right.
And then you say, okay, so what's the spiritual way of reading that text? If I'm to read it allegorically, if I'm going to read it spiritually, what's the spiritual way of reading that text? Well, the way the New Testament handles that is to say, okay, hurt, pain, injustice, the desire for vengeance, all these things are understandable. All these things are understandable. But if we live that way, we're going to die that way, right? So what's the New Testament solution? Christ. Christ is the New Testament solution. Christ comes and he bears all that alienation, all that pain, all that loss, all that injustice. Mm-hmm. He takes on the full weight, the full scope of human evil on himself. And yet, instead of, you know, raging back in revenge, he offers it in sacrifice to God out of love, and then is raised from the dead, conquering it, and provides a completely new way of being human, which ultimately conquers the world, but not through force of arms. And so there's this complete inversion, there's a revolution in human consciousness about how to confront the problem of evil. And the whole Old Testament narrative is kind of building us up for that, right? And you see these early solutions in the Old Testament to the problem of evil. Mm-hmm. You know, like, hey, maybe if I just do good, good things will happen. You know, bad things won't happen to good people. You find that in Deuteronomy. Then you find out, well, no, the world doesn't work that way. And so Job is a good person who has bad things happen to him. You see a development in the Old Testament, right, where later texts begin to critique earlier texts. And the trajectory, and then you get into the book of Daniel and Ezekiel, and you realize, okay, maybe my enemy is not flesh and blood. Maybe it's powers and principalities in the heavenly realms. And lo and behold, what does St. Paul say? Your enemy is not flesh and blood. It's powers and principalities in the heavenly realms. And so this language of warfare and combat and revenge gets kicked up into a higher sphere. And now it's not against my neighbor who I'm supposed to love and forgive, but it's against maybe the demonic forces at work in my own soul, right? So I use this, now becomes a metaphor, becomes kind of an allegory for the spiritual combat that takes place in my heart. That's exactly what Evagrius Ponticus does. He's one of the fathers of monastic theology. He has a robust theology of spiritual warfare. But where is the battle rage? It's not with the Canaanite, my neighbor. It's with lust, that part of my personality. It's with pride, that voice in the back of my head. It's with sloth, that demon that rages at the noontime to keep me from my work. These are the battles that I'm fighting. And I take the language of the Psalms, and I take the language of the exile, and I take the language of the Exodus, and I take the military imagery of the Old Testament, but I've transformed it. I've transposed it into a higher key and turned it into the spiritual realm. That's the way Catholics read the Old Testament.
Thank you so much for your question. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. One of our wonderful weekend programs I can certainly recommend to you is Conversations with Consequences. It's the weekly radio show of the Catholic Association, featuring conversations about the topics that matter to an educated and well-formed Catholic audience. Do check it out. We air it twice every Saturday for you, 7 a.m. and 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. Let's go now to George in New Jersey, listening on YouTube today. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go right ahead.
I just want to make a statement before I have a question, and that's just my own personal statement. When I pray to the Father because I believe the throne is open. And when they asked Jesus how to pray, he said, pray to the Father, the Our Father. Now, my question is, we are born, we are mortal souls. But Jesus himself is a, I believe, is a quickened spirit. Do you think he was born a mortal soul as a human?
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So it is a dogma of the Catholic faith that Jesus was fully human. If he were not fully human, then the second person in the Trinity was not joined to humanity, but to something else. But the incarnation is the salvation of humanity, not something else. Hence, Jesus is fully human. And it is integral to a human identity that we are in possession of a soul. You use the language mortal souls. The Catholic faith doesn't believe in mortal souls. We have immortal souls. Now, what quality of immortality, that will be dependent upon our reception of God's grace. But human souls are immortal souls. Not my dog has a mortal soul. When my dog dies, his soul goes with him. I have an immortal soul. When I die, my soul does not die. That's the Catholic doctrine. Whether you're Christian, not Christian, virtuous, vicious, you have an immortal soul. Is there an ontological difference, meaning a difference in the nature of being, between Christ's human soul and my human soul? No. No. Because if his soul is not ontologically the same thing as my human soul, then it's not a human soul. It's something else other than a human soul, and thus he's not human. So Christ is different from me in that in addition to a human nature, he is also joined in his person to the divine nature. I cannot be joined to the divine nature in that same way. I can be joined by way of participation, but not by union of the person. So Christ is different in that respect. But insofar as he's human, he and I share a common humanity, albeit his more sanctified considerably than mine.
George, thanks so much for your call. What did George, when George used the phrase quickened spirit, I'm not familiar with that phrase.
I don't know, but he differentiated it from mortal soul, and so I thought, well, why don't I just give out the Catholic understanding of Christ's soul? Now, I also make a comment about George's initial declaration that he believes the throne is open and he prays to the Father.
Yes.
He'd make a good Catholic in that respect, because every Catholic thinks the same thing, and we pray to the Father in according with the teaching of Jesus who gave us the Our Father. So
George,
we're right on board with you with
that. Yeah, yeah. George, thanks again for your phone call. Juan in Portland, Oregon called, could not hold on, but he did ask this question. Dr. Anders, I keep hearing so many people say the rapture will be on September 23rd. That's next Tuesday. There are a lot of people saying that, Juan says. What are your thoughts?
Would any of them be willing to sell real estate to me at very reduced prices, given that they won't need it next Wednesday? Like, I'd be willing to pay pennies on the dollar, okay? So that's how confident I am that we'll all be around next Wednesday.
Well,
okay?
All right.
Actually, that would be immoral. I wouldn't want to take advantage of people, you know, who have been duped by internet memesters. I wouldn't want to do that. I'm just making a joke. But no, seriously, the doctrine of the rapture is a modern Protestant fundamentalist dispensational doctrine with no foundation in sacred scripture or sacred tradition or in reason. And these kind of date-setting apocalypticists have been proven wrong again and again and again and again and again in Christian history. You would think that Jesus said, no one knows the day or the hour. We would have gotten the message by now. But every year, somebody new manages to hoodwink a bunch of people. And the business about selling your house for pennies on the dollar, you know, I meant that as a joke. But quite seriously, there was a prominent Protestant radio evangelist several years ago who managed to convince a lot of people the world was going to end on a particular date. And there were folks that emptied their bank accounts and sold their farms and this kind of thing, just to put up billboards, and then they all felt pretty silly when they woke up the next day and they were still here, you know, and they realized they'd been duped. So it's terrible. And that kind of date-setting apocalypticism has done a lot of harm in human history. And in particular, it has the capacity even to turn violent. So you know, there's a French historian named Denis Cluzet who wrote a book called The Warriors of God, arguing that that apocalyptic furor like this was highly relevant to the the initiation of the wars of religion in the 17th century, as well as the Protestant Reformation. Yeah. So, I mean, Philip Jenkins, who's a historian, not a Catholic historian, wrote a really fascinating book about World War I. And I forgot the title of the book, but you can look it up. And his thesis basically is that the sort of the furor of World War I had apocalyptic dimensions in the way that each side in the conflict saw its opponent in sort of like antichrist, you know, apocalyptic terms. And it's just bad for people. It's bad for culture. It's bad for history. That kind of approach to religious identity mongering, and I just think it's been proven wrong again and again and again, and it just keeps on happening, and it's just very harmful.
Juan, thanks for listening to us in Portland. Appreciate that. Lovak is watching us on YouTube today. Lovak says, what is the Protestant view on monasteries and those who choose the contemplative life?
Yes. So it really depends on the Protestant. It really depends on the Protestant. Martin Luther had very nasty things to say about monks and monasteries. Very nasty things to say. John Calvin had some pretty unfriendly things to say about monks and monasteries. Henry VIII, of course, saw monasteries as a great source of wealth that he could appropriate for himself and dole out to his friends. So there has been a lot of historic antagonism between Protestants and monasticism in the contemplative life. A little anecdote from my own personal history. I went to the seminary with an evangelical seminary, and I had a classmate who had grown up Catholic but had stopped practicing Catholicism, and she had become a evangelical Protestant of the Episcopal stamp, but she still had some fond feelings about the Catholic faith, and so she was kind of an oddball on campus in that regard because the official line was anti-Catholic. And she told me one time that when she graduated, she really wasn't going to go back and practice Catholicism, but she thought, you know, maybe I should take some time off and go pray. I'll take a year and just, you know, try to go hang out in a Catholic monastery and spend time in prayer.
Wow.
And she shared that with I won't say his name, but a very well-known Protestant biblical scholar. I mean, household name kind of biblical scholar, Baptist tradition. And he basically said, why would you want to waste time during something like that? Why don't you go to Japan and hand out tracts on the street for a year? That'd be a much better use of your time. Basically, really poo-pooing the idea that setting aside time for contemplative prayer would be a valuable exercise. So there is that dimension. There are Protestants that take a completely different line. So strangely, the Église Réformée in France, the Reformed Church in France, has Reformed convents. They have Protestant Reformed nuns.
Really?
Because I've met some of them. Yeah. There are Anglican Benedictines that practice they follow the rule of Saint Benedict, but in the Anglican Church.
Wow.
There are other kind of contemplative and quasi-contemplative Protestant communities that have been established over the years. The Teze community that makes all those very singable. It's like Catholic chant meets worship music, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's a deliberately ecumenical movement, right? You know, they sort of try to draw people from all traditions into that Catholic contemplative liturgical experience, and you'll find Protestants that are all up and about that sort of thing. So there's a range of responses, and there are Protestant monastics, and then there are some Protestants who are deeply anti-monastic.
There you go. And one final question from Daniel on YouTube, asking about how we can carry our cross as Catholics versus how Protestants might carry the cross, how Orthodox might carry the cross.
Okay. Well, you know, one image that strikes me
in
immediately.
One minute.
Yeah. And this is not what he intended, but like Catholics, we literally carry a cross.
Well, we do.
You know, we have a feast of the Exaltation of the Holy Cross.
Yeah.
And you will find Catholics physically carrying a cross, you know. And that sort of thing Protestants don't typically do, although sometimes they do. Look, Ella Fitzgerald saying, into each life some rain must fall.
Yes.
Right? But too much is falling in mine. But trouble is coming your way. I don't care if you're Protestant. I don't care if you're Catholic. I don't care if you're Orthodox. You're gonna have trouble, right? And how we respond to that? Do we embrace, to quote C.S. Lewis and King Trillian in The Last Battle, do we take the adventure that Aslan sends us or not? Do we embrace our fate or let it drag us along, right? And to the extent that we can say with Christ, "Not my will, but thine be done."
Yes.
Then we're we're bearing the cross with the attitude of Christian patience that we're meant to have. And as Catholics, we know that that attitude is meritorious. Protestants typically don't believe in merit. An interesting take on bearing the cross was Martin Luther King Jr., a Protestant theologian, who saw that this was also not only a form of private spirituality, but a form of public action.
Wow.
By going out and willingly suffering injustice, you know, without raising a hand in revenge, and loving one's neighbor very demonstratively was a way to bring about social change. And he was right.
He certainly was. Daniel, thanks for checking in on YouTube. Dr. David Anders, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
See you next time here on EWTN's Call to Communion. I'm Tom Price. We will see you then. God bless.